Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
Right now, and again in the second half of our show, ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles! That's-
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins.
Close your eyes and I'll kiss you. Tomorrow I'll miss you.
When the Beatles landed in 1964, it was a defining moment for the band and for this country. More than a half century later, the music, the image, and the spirit of the band seem as relevant as ever. Cambridge-based sociologist Candy Leonard thinks so. She's the author of a new book, Beatleness: How the Beatles and Their Fans Remade the World. She says Beatleness is something bigger than the band and their songs.
Beatleness also gets to the pervasiveness of them, the ubiquitousness of them for half a century. And the word also refers to that feeling that they evoke in listeners, that joyful feeling. One of the words that fans used over and over again in when I was interviewing them is joy. That's the Beatle word.
So what made you decide this should be the subject of a book?
Well, over the years, I've had many conversations with fans, informally, you know, people I know, talking about our experience growing up with the Beatles in the 60s. And every person who I get into these conversations with always said that it was a transformative experience. It was one of the most special things about their childhood. And I thought, wow, you know, this story needs to be documented. What was it like to grow up with the Beatles in the 60s, with them as a constant presence in your life and watching them unfold record after record? So when you talk to people about that experience of growing up with the Beatles, it's been obviously 50 years at this point, but they can still remember the first time they heard I Want to Hold Your Hand, the first time they saw them on Ed Sullivan, and when they opened up with All My Love. And people remember this as a transformative event in their lives. And I wanted to document that experience.
And please say to me, you let me hold your hand.
Now, most of the people who were in Sullivan's audience were young women, or teenagers at the time.
You mean in the studio?
In the studio at the time, right. The rest of us are screaming at home,
right?
Depending on how young we were.
It was predominantly female. There were some men there, too. I actually know a couple of men who were there. But yeah, it was predominantly female.
And you interviewed people who were born in 1945 to 52. Those were the teenagers at the time that they were on The Sullivan Show. Also 53 to 58, 59 to 61. How did they differ in their responses? Because some of them were like 5 years old when the Beatles were on Sullivan.
Exactly. We forget that a lot of the early, what we call first-generation fans, were actually children. And so if you think about what a child brings to art, you know, whatever level of understanding they bring, whatever developmental stage they're at, that was the process that happened with the Beatles. So let's take, for example, an album like Rubber Soul, which is where we really started to see the change, and a song like Norwegian Wood, which, you know, was heard by 8-year-olds, 9-year-olds, 10-year-olds, and 15-year-olds. They each processed it differently. They each drew something different out of it.
I once had a girl, or should I say, she once had me. She showed me her room, isn't it good, Norwegian wood.
It's a bit of a sophisticated song compared to I Want to Hold Your Hand. So how did they process, the fans process this differently depending on their age?
It is a sophisticated song. And so the younger fans didn't quite know what to make of it. They thought it was funny. Why is he sleeping in the bathtub? I mean, just as a visual image in their minds, it was humorous. They didn't quite get it. One fan I interviewed said, well, I didn't understand it, but I got the sense it was about some relationship, but it didn't end well. So, you know, they knew that it was about, you know, boy-girl relationships, as most pop music was at the time. And but they didn't quite know what to make of it. And then you move a little further up the age scale, and they'll say something like, well, it was kind of shocking that he was staying over, you know, that he wasn't going home, and that he was, you know, going to spend the night there. And then you have the oldest fans who would say, oh, yes, I remember that song, and to me it was all about sexual freedom. So depending on what the listener brought to the music. That's, you know, that was how they worked to interpret it. And they did work at it. That was the word that fans used over and over again, that at any age, that the songs, especially as the band evolved, as the music evolved, the songs required work. And that was part of the joy and the challenge, is to figure out, what is this song about? What are they telling us? You know, they really unified the baby boom generation, because if you think about, you know, the fans I interviewed for my book were born between 45 and 61. Well, that's a pretty big age gap. And, you know, and if you, you know, we're talking earlier about the differences that exist between people of these ages, developmental differences. So that was all operating. But yet, the Beatles unified this whole generation. So by the time you get to the whole Paul is dead craze in 1969, you had grade school and grad school people, you know, people of all ages got caught up in that and were, you know, sharing clues and talking about it. So they really unified baby boomers in a way that very little else did.
So what would be a good example of watching the maturation of the fans and the Beatles at the same time?
One song that comes to mind as the beginning of the change, if you will, would be I'm a Loser.
I'm a loser. I'm a loser. And I'm not what I appear to be.
It was not your usual boy meets girl pop song. It was very self-revelatory. It was introspective. And it was that familiar, the voice we had come to know at that point. It was John's voice, John singing. It was familiar to us. It had a Beatles sound, but it was different. There was something very different about it. And some of the fans who were in high school at the time remember bringing that song to school to discuss in an English class. Or, in other words, it started to be more artful. You know, that's where we start to get more, you know, it was beyond yeah, 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 and just infectious pop music. It started to have, for lack of a better word, gravitas.
Did that dismay younger fans or leave them perplexed?
Yes. This is where they say songs required work. But they didn't, you know, as long as there was kind of a, you know, it was still poppy, it was still infectious, it was still danceable. The lyrics were not off-putting. The total package was not off-putting. Where it starts to get disturbing for younger fans, and some older ones as well, is with Revolver. There were sounds on the record that no one had ever heard before, the backwards looping and all this. And a lot of young fans they don't say they didn't like it. They say they're not ready for it, because by 66, there was this reservoir of trust had been established. I mean, that's the thing. It was like they were such an integral part of our lives. You know, as one fan said, you wake up in the morning, you brush your teeth, you go to the bathroom, you put the Beatles on. You know, and so even if you didn't appreciate Tomorrow Never Knows or Love You Too on Revolver, you knew you would. The sense was, well, I'll appreciate it when I'm older.
He's a real nowhere man.
For example, City Nowhere Man, which I would consider in some ways their first political song.
Making all his nowhere plans for now.
The takeaway for fans from those lyrics, doesn't have a point of view, knows not where he's going to, isn't he a bit like you and me? The takeaway for fans was pay attention, look at the world around you, be tuned in. And there was also this sense of, isn't he a bit like you and me? In other words, that theme of us versus them started to emerge at a time when the media was becoming obsessed with the generation gap. Part of that was because of the escalating of the war in Vietnam and other things that were going on in the culture at the time. But Nowhere Man puts out a proposition. You should be engaged in the world. This whole generation gap that was very big at the time complemented this message that young people were getting in pop music, which actually served to further the generation gap.
Looking at things from this perspective now, it's easy to be cynical about how a group like the Beatles might be managed very carefully, pretending that John wasn't married at the time, which he was, so he would seem more available, etc. Was this kind of trajectory of their songs crafted?
It's who they were. I mean, it's who they were, and it's what they wanted to say at the time. I mean, they never set out to be leaders of the counterculture or to be offering guidance to young people. That was never the intent. They just wanted to play music, meet girls, make a lot of money, be bigger than Elvis.
Maybe that's why it all happened, because they didn't set out for it to happen.
Well, they were very persistent. In fact, their whole story, one of the reasons people of all ages, young people now, are very intrigued with their story is because it really is about perseverance and confidence and believing in yourself and making it happen. Because, I mean, they were rejected by so many record companies and they had so many disappointments in the early days, but they believed in themselves. They had enormous confidence and they had support of their families and friends in Liverpool. So they were able to make it happen.
Of course, it's the music that keeps younger generations coming back.
Right. I mean, ultimately, it's all about the music.
Candy Leonard is a sociologist and Beatles expert. She's the author of a new book called Beatleness: How the Beatles and Their Fans Remade the World. Nice to talk to you. Before we let you go, we have some Christmas messages from the Beatles, and this is right up your alley because these are messages that they put out year after year specifically for fans, to fan clubs.
Yeah, they were very, very appreciative of the fans, even though sometimes the fame got to be a little bit difficult. But yes, they did this for 8 years, I think, they put out Christmas records, and fans looked forward to hearing them, and they were off-the-cuff, humorous, chit-chat, the cheeky banter that we had come to know and love, and they're really wonderful artifacts from a very fun time.
Candy, thank you.
Thank you.
Can you wash it clean? Or can you wash your father's shirt? Or can you wash it clean?
Christmas!
Happy Christmas!
Happy Christmas! Happy Christmas!
And that's it for this Christmas Eve. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Best wishes for happy holidays from the Radio Boston crew. Producers Amory Sievertson, Alex Kingsbury, Emma Jean Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney, and Jamie Bologna. And, of course, Radio Boston anchors Anthony Brooks and Meghna Chakrabarty. Tim Skog is our technical director. I'm Lisa Mullins. Join us again tomorrow for a special Christmas edition of Radio Boston. Sunshine,